It is nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station here in beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where it is rainy, foggy, misty, and breezy, 42 degrees. At the airport, they are showing 96% humidity, northeast winds to 24 miles per hour, and 2.5 miles of visibility. Coming up on the Midday Report, Hurston Dobroth talks to a man with a mission to plant carrots. Two large and influential tribal organizations have pulled out of the Alaska Federation of Natives. And Congresswoman Mary Peltola is among House Democrats who are concerned the Supreme Court is about to weaken the Indian Child Welfare Act. Those stories and more after national headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. A defiant George Santos says he'll fight to clear his name and would even seek re-election. Today, the congressman from New York walked out of a courtroom where he just pleaded not guilty to federal charges of wire fraud, money laundering, theft of public funds, and making false statements to the House of Representatives.
It's a witch hunt because it makes no sense that in 4 months, 4 months, 5 months, I'm indicted.
Despite pressure from his constituents in New York's 3rd Congressional District, Santos says he has no intention of resigning from the House of Representatives. In fact, he told reporters,
I have to go back and vote. Tomorrow we have one of the most consequential votes in this Congress, which is a border bill, and I'm very looking forward to being there to vote on it.
Well, facing another round of negotiations Friday with congressional leaders over a debt limit, President Biden says he wants to know if the GOP's proposal to cut federal spending will include cuts in funds to Border Patrol. His remarks in New York made a day before the expiration of the pandemic-era public health restriction known as Title 42. More migrants from Latin America and around the world are arriving at the southern U.S. border, many to seek asylum. NPR's Joel Rose reports the Biden administration published its new asylum rule today.
The rule will make it much harder for migrants to get asylum if they cross the southern border illegally after passing through Mexico or another country. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas says it's part of a broader effort by the administration to discourage migrants from crossing the border illegally when the pandemic restrictions known as Title 42 end.
Our plan will deliver results, but it will take time for those results to be fully realized.
Administration officials concede the coming days and weeks may be chaotic. An influx of migrants is already underway. The union representing Border Patrol agents says more than 28,000 migrants are in custody, far above official capacity. Joel Rose, NPR News, El Paso.
CNN hosts a live town hall tonight with former President Donald Trump, a day after the Republican was found liable at a New York civil trial for sexual abuse and defamation against columnist E. Jean Carroll. Here's NPR's David Folkenflik.
In the past, Trump has attacked CNN relentlessly. He's now set to appear on CNN to promote his third bid for the White House and to slap down Fox News, which has been promoting Republican Florida Governor Ron DeSantis for its viewers. Meanwhile, CNN has been trying to move past hostility from Republicans for having hosts outspokenly critical of Trump. CNN political director David Chalian tells NPR that Trump poses unique challenges given all his crises and controversies, his two impeachments, and his conduct on January 6, 2021. Then there's Trump's ability to bulldoze interviewers with bombast false claims and lies. Now CNN's Caitlin Collins will have to press Trump on the verdict too, all while handling questions from those voters. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR.
Ang NPR Balita ay hatid sa inyo ng Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. Para sa kaukulang impormasyon tungkol sa aming mga serbisyo, tumawag lamang sa 481-2400.
For KMXT, I'm Terry Haynes. Kodiak Island is home to a burgeoning local food movement, one that could get a whole lot bigger this summer thanks to one gardener's ambitious plan to plant 500,000 carrots across the archipelago. KMXT's Kirsten Dobroth brings us this story.
You could say Dave Jackson is Kodiak's carrot kingpin. Jackson's got a thriving garden at his house on the sunny side of Bell's Flats, just past Kodiak's Coast Guard base. There's onions and asparagus and rhubarb and beds of greens. But carrots are the main attraction.
Three out of these four beds right in front here is where I'm going to grow carrots. And I grow quite a few carrots. I give a lot away. I probably put 2,000 seeds in there.
That might seem like a lot of carrots, but it pales in comparison to Jackson's bigger goal for this summer, to distribute 1,000 growing kits, each containing hundreds of carrot seeds, to gardeners across the island.
The goal is to put 500,000 seeds out there and try to get people to plant them.
But Jackson says the plan started off much smaller. One of his friends asked if he could put together a carrot planting packet to give to the neighborhood kids, who kept eating carrots out of his garden. So he posted on Facebook to ask if other people wanted their own packets too.
It got like 150 hits right off the bat. I went, whoa. Next day I ordered this bucket of seeds.
Jackson worked as a fisherman and then for Alaska's Department of Fish and Game for 3 decades. He says carrots are perfect for commercial fishing communities like Kodiak. You can leave them for weeks at a time, which is especially convenient with salmon season on the horizon.
I learned how to do these carrots high intensity, low maintenance. I do no thinning and no weeding. And so once I get the carrots up a couple of inches, I can go away and go fishing or whatever and come back in 6 weeks and start eating carrots.
Each carrot kit comes with an envelope filled with 500 seeds and everything you need to plant them. Jackson says the kits are perfect for aspiring or established gardeners, and they're available for free at locations around Kodiak, including the Little Store in Bell's Flats and Kodiak Harvest Food Co-op. He's not shipping the kits outside Kodiak, but they have made it to other parts of the state, including Homer and the Aleutian Chain. He says he doesn't have a long-term goal for the project, just that at least this summer, it means more locally grown food will end up on people's plates.
I really don't have a way to judge how effective we are, you know, scientifically or anything, but I'm expecting there's going to be lots of carrots.
Jackson's advice is to plant by mid-May to have carrots in time for fall. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobroth.
A decision from two large and influential tribal organizations to pull out of the Alaska Federation of Natives has had mixed reactions. Some are shocked to hear that the Thlinkit and Haida tribes and the Tanana Chiefs Conference have pulled out, while others say they're not surprised. AFN was formed to fight for land claims more than a half century ago and has continued to serve as a powerful voice for Alaska Natives in both state and national politics. Every October, it holds the state's largest convention. Both tribal organizations have cited different reasons for parting company with AFN. Thlinkit and Haida, which represents 35,000 tribal members in southeast Alaska, says it no longer needs AFN's advocacy because it has developed its own capacity to advance its causes. Thlinkit and Haida President Richard Peterson says the tribe still plans to collaborate with AFN.
I don't want it to look like a divorce. I keep using the analogy, we're the kids who grew up and are moving out of the house. We might still come home for a home-cooked meal or to do laundry now and again, right?
Peterson says the tribe would like to use the money it pays in dues to AFN to focus on region-specific issues. The Tanana Chiefs Conference, which represents villages in interior Alaska, said in a statement that it was ending its membership in AFN to focus on protecting salmon, one of the main sources of food for the region. It says numerous resolutions have passed during the AFN conventions over the years, but it's seen little action on steps to protect the Alaskan native subsistence lifestyle. Some longtime leaders in AFN have called the move to pull out of AFN a mistake. Paul Ontaguk, an Alaska native historian, agrees. He worries that the benefits of AFN are being taken for granted.
about really a fifth of the population of Alaska. So if we're going to influence things, punch above our weight, we have to have a kind of unity that reflects a sense of shared purpose.
In the last 3 years, disputes between regions have arisen during AFN's annual conventions. In that time, three regional corporations have pulled out of AFN, the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, Doyon, and the Aleut Corporation. Arctic Slope is the state's wealthiest private corporation. Doyon is Alaska's largest private landowner. Ontuguk says those organizations may someday need a group like AFN in a crisis to speak as one voice for the Alaskan Native community, and that their departure weakens the organization. He says AFN is still one of the most influential Native organizations in the nation. But he also says that trouble has been brewing within the ranks of AFN for a long time, and says these departures raise questions about the health of AFN.
Is it adapting? Is it reflecting the broad spectrum of interests of Alaska Native peoples and organizations? And by pulling out, it's a way of voting publicly a lack of confidence.
AFN's longtime president, Julie Kitka, says she's withholding comment about the withdrawals from the Federation until after an AFN board meeting next week. Alaska Congresswoman Mary Peltola and other House Democrats say they're worried that the U.S. Supreme Court is about to weaken the Indian Child Welfare Act to the detriment of Native children and their tribes. Peltola, the first Alaskan Native person elected to Congress, previously worked as a tribal court judge where child custody cases were a mainstay. At a congressional roundtable on Tuesday, Peltola stressed the importance of keeping children with their families or placing them within the tribe.
I think for every single human group ever in existence, children are precious. Children are our future. And certainly for Natives, it is no different.
The Supreme Court is expected to rule soon on a challenge to ICWA brought by the state of Texas and a group of non-Native adoptive parents. They say the Indian Child Welfare Act makes unconstitutional distinctions based on race. Supporters of ICWA say it's based on tribal affiliation. Congress originally passed the Indian Child Welfare Act in an attempt to reverse what had been a policy of wholesale alienation of children from their tribes. New York University law professor Maggie Blackhawk says the trend reached terrifying levels by the 1950s and 60s.
State governments separated over 100,000 of the estimated 400,000 Native children from their parents and placed those children in homes with no political, cultural, or linguistic connection to their nations.
The case is called Brackeen versus Holland. The justices heard arguments in November. A ruling is expected by the end of June. Alaska State Troopers received a report of a death in Uganic Bay on the west side of Kodiak Island on Friday. Troopers identified the woman as 33-year-old Ruby Blake of Seward. She was found deceased about 100 yards from a boat belonging to a hunting outfitter she worked for. Troopers have not released much information, although, according to an agency dispatch, they conducted an on-scene investigation and do not suspect foul play. Blake was the only adult on the boat at the time of her death. Troopers say her family has been notified and her body brought to the state medical examiner's office in Anchorage for examination. The National Day of Awareness for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls is held annually on May 5th. In Nome, nearly 100 people observe the day with a peaceful march and a speaker's event. KNOM's Greg Knight reports on how the day was observed.
A walk to commemorate those who are loved and lost, as well as for survivors, family members, and friends, was held downtown. The people who marched wore red face paint and red shirts and cried out for justice. That audio was courtesy of Kowarik, Inc. According to research by the Centers for Disease Control, homicide is the third leading cause of death among Native girls and women aged 10 to 24, and the fifth leading cause of death for Native women aged 25 to 34. Similar research by the U.S. Department of Justice has shown 4 out of 5 Native women have experienced some form of violence in their lifetime. Kirsten Timbers is president of the Village of Solomon. At an event before the march, she told the audience about the mishandling of an investigation into her aunt's death in Anchorage and how her family was never the same after.
I was 9 years old, and my life was forever changed. The bullet of injustice from our legal system struck me right through the heart. And because her death is a systematic problem that's rooted in oppression and trauma from discriminatory laws, we are all affected.
Melanie Banky, the president and CEO of Cowerick Inc., spoke to a resolution passed by the organization's board in 2005, one that would start the process of identifying and tracking the missing and murdered in rural Alaska.
Our board passed a resolution asking for an investigation into the missing persons and the people who had died under suspicious circumstances. And we started soliciting names from family members so that we could have what I call an unofficial list of missing persons or unsolved deaths that we were aware of.
Banky went on to list the names of people whose deaths or disappearances were suspicious. The list did not include cases that could have been hunting accidents or suicides. Deila Johnson is one of the main organizers of the event. She told the crowd when any person goes missing or is murdered, it affects the whole community.
Each of us is affected, whether or not they are related to us. If it's not our best friend, if it's not our sister or our cousin, it could be our neighbor. It's somebody that works at our grocery store and we're checking out our eggs or getting our milk. We see those faces that shape our community, and those are still our family.
Megan Sig-Topcock is a staff attorney for Cowerick and a member of the Nome Common Council. She said she was pleased that state and federal governments are finally honoring domestic violence protective orders issued by tribal courts.
I'm really proud that we have at least four tribes in the region who have utilized their tribal courts to issue domestic violence protective orders. We're very fortunate that under the reauthorizations to the Violence Against Women Act that tribal court protective orders are afforded full faith and credit by the state federal agencies. Those are enforced even internationally. And so when a tribe steps in and says, hey, we have someone who needs protection, they can go to state federal law enforcement.
During her visit to Nome on Friday, Lieutenant Governor Nancy Dahlstrom said she advocates for keeping the memories of relatives and community members who were missing and murdered with us.
It's important that we keep reminding people that someone's loved ones, you know, didn't come home. And so I'm pleased to be here for that.
Retired Alaska State Trooper Lonnie Piscoya, who was raised in Nome, returned last year to the Alaska Department of Public Safety to lead the department's Missing or Murdered Indigenous Persons Initiative. May 5th was designated as the Day of Awareness for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls, as it was the birthday of Hannah Harris, a member of the Northern Cheyenne Tribe who went missing and was murdered in 2013. Reporting in Nome with help from Sonny Bean in Bethel and Inyarok Evans in Nome, I'm Greg Knight.
Rising temperatures are advancing river breakup in the eastern interior. National Weather Service hydrologist Ed Plum says ice is moving on smaller rivers, including the 40 Mile, where an ice jam on the Mosquito Fork elevated water levels at the Taylor Highway Bridge near Chicken on Tuesday.
The ice was actually up to the base of the bridge, with water flowing over the bank, not impacting the road, but flowing over the bank into the woods in that area.
Plum says there was also some high water on Birch Creek along the Steese Highway west of Circle.
We had some ice running down that raised the water level and pushed water into an old channel, which then actually ended up inundating part of the Steese Highway, kind of around mile 145 west of Circle.
Plum says breakup will accelerate in coming days as temperatures are forecast to be warm
into the 60s, and we may see some isolated 70s, actually, the first of the year in the eastern interior, maybe closer to the Alcan border. And that's really going to get the snow melt in the higher elevations running off into the rivers.
Plum says the Yukon River at Dawson has broken up, and breakup at Eagle is expected soon. He says varying ice conditions were observed on Tuesday between the Alcan border and Circle.
Some areas were starting to show some decay, but actually up near Eagle, there were still some areas that still look like they had strong ice. And once we do get the ice moving, there is a potential we could get some ice jams up in that region.
Plum says a river watch team is flying the upper Yukon, keeping a close eye on conditions. Alaska's fire season is in full swing. As of Tuesday afternoon, there have been 24 fires so far. Six of those were discovered within the last 24 hours. Beth Ipson, spokesperson for the Bureau of Land Management Alaska Fire Service, joined Talk of Alaska on Tuesday morning. She says the majority of those early season fires were ignited by human activity.
There was a fire escape from Burn Barrel. There was one on a shooting range on Chena Hot Springs Road. And then a couple others, like a campfire.
Dead grasses and plant debris exposed by melting snow are prime fire start material. Fire managers are encouraging Alaskans to be careful with possible ignition sources, such as chainsaws or ATVs, and to ready homes for fire season by moving firewood stacks away from buildings and clearing brush away from properties. Well, this year's heavy snowpack and cold spring pushed back the start to fire season in many parts of the state. Climate change is generally causing an earlier snow melt, says climatologist Rick Toman.
We've lengthened the wildfire season. It was just last year we had the Kwikluk fire that burned over 10,000 acres in April, and the very early start to the fire season in southwest Alaska.
Toman also noted that with the climate warming, lightning is becoming more frequent in some areas, including southwest Alaska. Data shows that humans typically cause more fires in Alaska than lightning, but lightning-caused fires account for the vast majority of acres burned.
Today's KMXT local news is brought to you in part by Discover Kodiak, a one-stop source for visitor information on Kodiak and other destinations around the state. On the web at kodiak.org and at the Visitor Center in the Ferry Terminal Building at 100 Marine Way, 486-4782.
Inflation last month grew, and it also shrank. I'm Nova Safa with the Marketplace Minute. It's all about what you compare against. Compared to the month before, prices the U.S. consumer paid rose nearly 0.5% between March and April. So costs are going up, but compared to last year at the same time, price increases are not as steep. On an annual basis, the Labor Department's Consumer Price Index moderated slightly, down to 4.9%. Tomorrow, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen will meet with her counterparts at a conference of G7 countries in Japan. She's expected to address the debt ceiling standoff, U.S. regional bank problems, and the failure to ratify a 15% global minimum tax on corporations. The U.S. Senate is blocking that measure. I'm Nova Safa with the Marketplace Minute.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Wednesday. It is the 10th day of May, the year 2023. The sun rose at 5:57 this morning. It will set again at 10:16. That will give us 16 hours and 19 minutes of daylight, a gain of 4 minutes and 21 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record high for this date was 68 degrees, set in 1967, and our record low temperature was 26, set in 1930. Currently 42 degrees, it's foggy, it's misty, it's breezy, and there's a light rain falling. Out at the airport, they are showing northeast winds to 24 miles per hour. They are down to 2.5 miles of visibility and up to 96% humidity. The Weather Service is calling for rain for the rest of the day. Could be heavy at times through the night as well. Look for 1/2 to 3/4 of an inch today. East winds to 20. For tonight, look for a low around 40 and southeast winds to 15. Thursday, just showers likely, mainly before 1 p.m. Mostly cloudy skies on Thursday with a high of 46. East winds to 15, gusting to 20. For Thursday night and Friday, just scattered showers. Rain is likely on Friday night and Saturday. Looking at our local tides, we just are now having a low tide here on the east side just this minute. It's a minus 8/10 of a foot tide, followed by a high tide at 7:10 p.m. at 6.1 feet. Over on the west side, your low tide will happen in about 15 minutes at 12:44 p.m. That will be minus 1.1 feet, followed by a high tide at 7:21 p.m. of 10.9 feet in Larson Bay. Mariners, here's your forecast for Marmot Island to Sitkanak out to 15 miles offshore. Gale warning for today. Northeast 35, should come down to 25 this afternoon, 12-foot seas. For tonight, east winds to 15 knots, except north of Dangerous Cape, east wind to 25 knots, becoming southeast 15 after midnight. Seas to 11 feet tonight on our east side. And for tomorrow, east winds to 20 knots and seas to 9 feet. Offshore on our east side, Marmot Island to Sitkanak out to 85 miles offshore. Look for a small craft advisory through Thursday. With east winds to 30 knots today, seas to 13 feet. For tomorrow, east winds to 20 knots and seas to 9 feet. Over in the Shelikof Strait, gale warning through tonight. Northeast 45 today, seas to 14 feet. For tonight, northeast 40, becoming east 30 after midnight. Seas 14 feet, subsiding to 9 feet after midnight tonight. For tomorrow, on our west side, northeast 25, seas to 6 feet. The Kodiak City Council will be having a regular meeting on Thursday. Tomorrow at 7:30 p.m., this meeting will be held in the Kodiak Public Library and broadcast live here on KMXT. You can listen on 100.1 FM. It will also be web-streamed, and the web-streaming link and meeting packets are available online at the City of Kodiak website. If you have any questions at all, contact the City Clerk's Office at 907-486-8636. Meetings going on in the Kodiak Island Borough include tonight's meeting of the Planning and Zoning Commission. They're having a work session in the Borough Assembly Chambers at 6:30 p.m. Tomorrow, the Borough Assembly will be having a work session in the Kodiak Island Borough Assembly Chambers at 6:30 p.m. Next Wednesday, a week from tonight, the Planning and Zoning Commission will be having their regular meeting in the Borough Assembly Chambers at 6:30 p.m. And a week from Thursday is the Assembly's next regular meeting, also in the Borough Assembly Chambers, also at 6:30 p.m. All meetings are open to the public, and packets are available at the Kodiak Island Borough website. Contact the Borough Clerk's Office at 907-486-9310 with any questions. Have you ever wondered about your family's history? Where are you from? What's your family story? The Kodiak History Museum, Kodiak Public Library, and St. Herman's Theological Seminary Archives have the event for you. Join them on Thursday, May 18th. That is a week from this next coming Thursday, from 5:30 to 7 p.m. for the genealogical event of the year at the Kodiak Public Library. This free event will teach you how to start your genealogical journey and show you with demonstrations all the resources available to you. For more information, call the Kodiak History Museum at 907-486-5920. May is Mental Health Awareness Month. Suicide is a reality many in our community have to live with, but what do you know about it and how can you talk about it? Learn how to support each other's mental health by joining the Kodiak Women's Resource and Crisis Center for a free presentation, Talk Saves Lives, on Wednesday, May 17th. That's a week from tonight, 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. at the Kodiak Women's Resource and Crisis Center. It's free and open to the public. You can email them at outreach@kwrcc.org or call them on the phone at 907-486-6171 for more information. The Lutic Museum's redesigned community meeting is coming up. That's next Tuesday, May 16th, from 5:30 to 7 p.m. in the Lutic Museum. The Aleutic Museum is renovating its gallery, and they've been working hard to plan their new exhibits. Join them for their third and final community conversation. It will be facilitated by Exhibit AK. Come share your ideas and give input on the design of their new renovated gallery. Again, that's going on next Tuesday, 5:30 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the Aleutic Museum. Matson is hosting the Kodiak Cleanup Giveaway, including $2,500 in prizes. To encourage Kodiak citizens to clean up the Emerald Isle this spring, Matson is giving away $2,500 in prizes for a third consecutive year. To enter, residents upload a photo of themselves cleaning up Kodiak at www.matsoncleanupgiveaway.com/Kodiak by May 13th. Winners will be selected by random, notified by email, and announced on Facebook. This year, 20 winners will each receive $125 loyal to local gift cards from the Kodiak Chamber of Commerce.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT three times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the midday report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.